Okay, I'm on the line with Derek DeKirchhoff again, and we're continuing our ongoing conversation, dialogue, interview, whatever. And Derek has a question first.
Yes, it comes from the lovely paper by Don Thiel on Joyce, and making me finally understand Finnegan's Wake. Yes, but there's a point here that I'd like to hear your opinion about, because I'm particularly interested in the issue, but I didn't quite get it, so you can help maybe. So I'm going to read it to you.
Okay.
If language is rooted in gesture, it is obvious that the rhythm of language is closely connected with the body and its internal communication systems. Significant gestures arouse analogous patterns in both speaker and receiver, owing to their co-presence in a common social or physical milieu. In experience, we internalize the external conversation of gestures. Joyce then has, in Ulysses and the Wake, a method by which the communication between his characters and the world of the book is an analog of the communication between the book and the world of reality. And that's what I miss. I'm perfectly happy with. Yeah, we internalize the external conversation of gestures. Absolutely. We internalize the reading we do. Not everybody, but most people sort of, you know, read under their reading. So that's not a difficult one. But what I don't get is this idea. The communication between the character and the world of Ulysses and Wake and the world of the book is an analog for the communication between the book and the world of reality.
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't get that. I have no idea what it means.
Okay, so in the, I think it's page 23 of Counterblast, 1969, second version, he talks about nonverbal mental gesture. I think that's the phrase. He's trying to describe ESP, nonverbal mental gesture. So gesture includes the mind as well as the visible gesture.
Yeah, there's a wonderful book about that called The Body in the Mind. And I forgot the title. Johnson is the guy who wrote it, but his first name I can't remember. But the book is just about that. It's how there's another one that I always found interesting as well. Collected essays by it'll come back. It's called Plans and Procedures for Gestures, and it is with Carl Pribram, for example, who is sort of the least scientific of the bunch, but Irvin and Galanter.
Yeah.
And that is a fabulous book that describes that before we make a gesture, we have already planned it in our mind. In other words, the plan comes before the actuation. It's not an automatic actuation. So it's very interesting to read, you know, that and then get the scientific backing for it.
Right. So people think ESP is thought to thought, and that's visually biased abstraction. They don't recognize that when I'm talking to you in person, your body language is communicating thoughts to me. Nonverbal mental gesture. Gesture is mental, involves thought. That's a very important point to understand what the range of what ESP can be. It's not some...
Oh, I'm perfectly happy with that. What I'm not happy with is the comparison he makes.
Right, to the word... Between,
I have no idea what he means. I mean, the communication between his characters, all right, so Bloom or whatever, or Finnegan, and the world of the book. What world of the book?
That's the content.
It's an analog communication between the book and the world of reality. Had he said it's analog to the communication between my body and the world of reality, I would get it. But what about, you know, I don't see it.
Okay, so I just established that as that was the background. Because I always, I learned something from that quote when I read that 40 years ago, the nonverbal mental gesture. That's how I learned, how I got an idea about what McLuhan's talking about. So in Don Thiel's saying that the relationship between the characters and Dublin, the medium, the content of the book is one ratio. And that's the same as book to the electric age, or whatever age, but it is the electric age in 1904. So... the relationship, that's what McLuhan's point. People think that the medium is a message. The medium affects you personally, your visual or acoustic bias. That's puny compared to how electric media affects books and newspapers and speech and prints and all previous media that went before. That is the definition of medium, all the media that are already there in the society. So the relationship between the new figure, the new technology, and what's already given, the medium, is the same between Joyce and the world he's writing in the present. This would be 1922 to 1939. So Joyce is interacting with the world and its environment. And that relationship of Joyce to the electric world and how it's registered in the book medium is the same as the characters to the milieu inside Finnegan's Wake or Ulysses.
Interesting. Very interesting.
You got
okay,
something
so
there? Okay.
Huh?
You got something there. You get it.
I did. No, that's very good. It's very helpful. I told you I needed to have that. So now let me get to the thick of it. By the way, I just had lunch with Eric McLuhan.
Did he have a comment about the conference the other night?
He thought that the paper that was given by Bruce was excellent.
Okay, good.
Excellent. No, I think it was, he thought, yeah, he enjoyed himself, and he was actually, it was lovely. Him and Sabina were very, very friendly and fun. So, and they're both, they're getting on, but they're in, touch with decent health.
Right. Well, let's see. Yeah. Well, anything about the conversation you want to mention?
About the conversation, I'm glad to say, to report that publishers are now interested in his stuff again. He's got 7 books out, so imagine the guy with the 7.
Yeah, I mean, he's got 7 books ready to go, you mean?
7 books ready to go. He never stops. He loves it, and he's very good at it. I mean, he's an excellent writer. He gave me a paper, which is really worth reading. It's a long one. About common sense.
Okay.
Communis.
Right.
Good. I mean, he really thinks very well. So anyway, that was fun. Now, I'm looking for the place that we had. It was yesterday, right?
McLuhan on Maui?
Yep.
We've done the Thiel thing. So basically, Thiel is talking about the actual meaning of the medium as a message in that sentence that we just talked about.
Yeah. No. Agreed. Now, what? This is not opening. Oh. There it is. It's very much. And then it ends with this wonderful quote: "I'm Yush, my semblable, my freer."
Yes, from Baudelaire.
Yeah.
My McLuhan used to define that as the essence of put on. The poet, in this case Baudelaire, is putting on the reader, and is. The semblable, my semblable, I'm not sure, semblable, however you say it, my brother, he's talking about several relationships there. User is
but Shem is Shem and Sean, and the penman. Shem, Sean the penman, character. That's what Shem is. So semblable is semblable, which means similar, my look-alike. Or,
right.
And my freer, which is mon frère in French, which is my brother. But it's interesting how he keeps the sound but changes completely the meaning.
Right. Well, he's talking about the put-on. The artist puts the reader on, and the reader distorts the artist or the content, that interplay, tactile interplay, that McLuhan talks about later. As a matter of fact, I always recommend there's a great letter about 1971. McLuhan's writing Trudeau around the time that Trudeau got married, which I think was March 6th, to Margaret Trudeau. He talks about how the press uses the figure Trudeau for content, and Trudeau uses the press as content. If you've never noticed that letter, it's very it's beyond the normal user's content situation.
Huh.
Matter of fact, if you have the letters there, and you just could drag it out, we could read that letter, because it's very interesting how he never says what he says to Trudeau to ever again. It's as far as I know.
Interesting.
Never right.
That's interesting. No, yeah. I don't have the book is buried in a huge pile in the shed right now because I haven't been here, so I can't put that stuff together.
Okay, I'll get it later if we have time. But,
sure, that would be cool.
Yeah, it's a very good quote. Very important how he. So that is what the way he describes that, the mutual putting on of each other, the reader and the writer and the writer and the reader. Is described in Trudeau's relationship to the press and the press's relationship to Trudeau. It's very interesting.
Very good.
Right. So now we're looking at.
At Barry Nevitt, and I'm into the list of the what Barry was emphasizing on the semantics and the probes of Marshall.
Yeah, what should
break
be,
down
so
and break through, the environment turns the old environment to an art form, rear view mirror. These are very good ideas, by the way. But so I've got them all. I'm looking at all of those, and there was one that I, again, an extension of the previous question, but more expanded. What is your view on Joyce's use of the tactile aesthetic. You sort of explained it before, but say it again.
Okay, this is a separate question, not about...
It's one of the things that Barry has put in his list of what he probably felt more useful or valuable as the method of finding things out.
Where do you see that? Which list is that? The science of generalism correction or...
No. It's with...
A little earlier.
No. It's, you know, when
oh, yeah, the list. I see what you have.
There's a list.
Here.
It's very visible. Breakdown is breakthrough.
Yes. Whereas others in the... Okay, so this is an essay I did called... We have started to discuss this. We originally were going to do this essay, and we went into the first part, which is about Barry Nevitt, but we got distracted with the Thiel issue, or worthwhile sidebar, and that's done.
Easily.
Yeah, that's done. The essay is called Literary Aesthetic Cliché Probes in the American Classroom Without Walls. And this is what I wrote 12 years ago. So I think this is my list of themes of McLuhan. Let me just scroll down here. I put together as many themes. It's like I'm doing a Bob Logan, you know, inventorying everything that McLuhan intimated. So I go, whereas others in the post-McLuhan, that's after McLuhan died in the end of 1980, in the post-McLuhan Toronto School of Media Ecology, so we're talking about the Toronto School, which is Barry, Eric, and Nelson mm-hmm. Thal, others merely emphasize one or more of the old McLuhan themes. So I'm listing the old McLuhan themes. And one of them, I think, is the tactile statement, right? Which one?
That's right.
Yes. Joyce's use of the tactile aesthetic. Now, this mm-hmm. is really important, and you get a hint of it in Through the Vanishing Point, the final poems, paintings, when he's doing Jackson Pollock and Homer, he begins, mm-hmm. and he brings in Ulysses. He points out that he has a quote from maybe Ulysses by Joyce, and I think it's the Walking Along the Strand, and it's... He's showing how Joyce is trying to show not visible, not auditory, but tactile and kinetic. Now, tactile is not a sense. So how do you show the tactile aesthetic? You have to include a synesthesia, all the senses, and imply something else. And for me, the tactile aesthetic is the fact that in the end, you don't find any idea or theme at the bottom of you, of at least Finnegan's Wake and maybe Ulysses. There is nothing at the bottom. There's nothing there. And that would be how you would express tactility, which is not a sense, but the interplay of the senses. You get my point?
True. No, I do. And I'm glad you pointed out, because also Marshall did quote Thomas Aquinas on the matter from the Summa, saying that touch was the common sense.
Yes.
Eric's article I was just talking about is just about that, about, you know, touch as a common sense. It's very interesting, very, very useful. I wish I had had you guys writing for my book on Point of Being, but I'll have a second edition.
Okay, so the other point is, in the do line, I don't think it's ever seen before, Marshall has his symbol for tactility. And you know what it is? It's a square without any content. That's a very interesting point. Like, people think a frame is visual space, you know, you frame. But he's actually showing a square, even, and that might look like visual space, but it isn't. He's saying it's tactility. It has no content, but it's a ratio of the four senses. Remember, McLuhan used to say we have four senses. Sure. He wouldn't go with the five. You know, we had four senses. So the square and an interplay between them with nothing inside the square is his image of tactility. So look at, and remember, that is Joyce's symbol for Finnegan's Wake when he's writing the book. Remember, he has his sigla, his symbols for the characters. It's laid out in Roland McHugh's book. And I think the symbol for Finnegan's Wake is exactly that, an empty square. So McLuhan's almost using a symbol for tactility, the one that Joyce used.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Well, I'm very happy about the exploration of that particular dimension now, because it requires a lot more than I have already put into it.
Right, and here's another thing. The TV set is a square with no content, because the viewer makes the content. So even the old black and white TV might be implied by Marshall's symbol for tactility.
It could be.
The extension. But these... I'm assuming people are looking at the article. If not, and they can always email me if they want it, I want to go through the themes here because I think it's a pretty good inventory I've created here. Let's see if you can come up with something that I left out. So McLuhan's themes were breakdown is breakthrough, the new environment turns the old environment into an art form or a rearview mirror, Pound's aphoristic style and technique of poetic synchronicity, preference for percept rather than concept, delight in the transformation of language and insight via punning, Yeats's emotion of multitude, the strategy of Poe's wise sailor in A Descent in the Maelstrom, Eliot's auditory imagination, and I'll supplement that by saying he wrote a letter to Playboy in 1970 saying, Eliot's auditory imagination, as a critical statement back in the 20s or 30s, is normal, ordinary awareness in 1970, you know, due to the rock era, so to speak, rock and roll. And he says, Finnegan's Wake has not entered the conscious life of the average person yet. Now, it's pretty interesting that Marshall's gauging when Finnegan's Wake becomes into a general sensibility like Eliot's auditory imagination. I would say if Marshall was around during the Internet, Web 1.0 or Web 2.0, he would say that Finneganese, that sensibility, the population would begin to awake to Finnegan's Wake and what it is as an expression, and that is why groups now.
Hello?
And are you there?
Yeah, I am. There was just a break.
Okay. That's why there were so many. There are so many Finnegan's Wake reading groups now, and the younger generation find it a lot easier to read Finnegan's Wake because they've grown up in a synesthetic and co-anesthetic, that's the other term they'll use, it, environment, so that just like rock made the auditory imagination commonplace or part of the common sensus communis, Finnegan's Wake is understandable now after the Internet. So I just want to add that point, that's my theory, that Marshall could say that in 1970, Finney's Wake was not part of the cliche awareness of citizens, of global theaters participants, but it would be in the Internet phase.
So there's Marshall's style is an Internet age style, hypertextual.
Yes. Yeah.
I've got three more for you.
Okay,
I just got three more.
Okay, yeah, you try that. Let me finish these.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, stressing of rhetorical devices and downplaying of dialectical ploys. Technological environments as numbing extensions of ourselves. Wyndham Lewis's valuation of the detached eye and collage of varying graphics. Grammar is the root of media awareness. Encyclopedism's advantages over specialism. Joyce's use of the tactile aesthetic. The dropping of a moral stance after the mechanical bride, Marshall McLuhan, 1951. Spotlight of advertising and its appropriation of artistic effects. Now, you know what what's not included there is that McLuhan was dialectical because his books, which are a dialectical medium for Western man, he presented nothing but dialectics, hot and cool, visual versus acoustic, eye versus ear. So I would have added that point, but that's sort of like a meta point with these themes as the content of his writing.
I've always found the dynamics of sensory input, sensory closure, center margin, eye versus ear. I've always found the dynamics very useful, very, very
Cartesian. Very Cartesian.
No, they were probes.
Yes, they're probes, but it would be a dialectic. I mean, you know.
For sure.
In other words, Marshall, many people say he's a rhetorician or grammarian. Mark Stallman emphasizes this and plays down the dialectic. But Marshall,
you're right. That's definitely a dialectical bent.
The trivium and the quadrivium is in all Marshall's work, not just the rhetorical grammatic side.
Yeah.
And that's important. Yeah. He played the whole trivium and quadrivium. I mean, Baudrillard says McLuhan's a musician. That is correct. And that's one of the.
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, that is one of the parts of the quadrivium is music.
Oh yeah, so that's very interesting. I didn't know that. I knew that the quadrivium had music, but I didn't know that.
That Baudrillard was saying that. He said, "I basically regard McLuhan as a musician." Now that's a tremendous statement, and he did that like early '90s or something.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So you want to add 3 points?
No, I just not really. I mean, the main point being that the dialectical system was a valuable tool, and that McLuhan himself, you know, used them all the time.
Right.
So as I've always found the toolbox of McLuhan interesting, because you need one.
Okay, I have another point. Are you aware that on page 52 of Finnegan's Wake, it says, television kills telephony or telephony in Brothers Broil?
It's Broil, I remember that.
Yeah, the eyes demand their turn, let them be seen. So Joyce retrieved the book and made the content, you know, unreadable, but that was the synesthetic electric environment he saw was happening around him in the 20s and 30s, especially via shortwave radio. But he frames it, contains it by the book, a tactile book, and that's how he retrieves visual space and how he, what he means when he says the eyes demand their turn, let them be seen. You let the eye be a function in the matrix of the interplay of electronic media in the 20th century in the global village phase by making book. And it used to be Marshall used to say, what is the role of the book? How do you do book? And so he would do book as dialectical.
Mm-hmm.
He would, as figure, go on, talk about acoustic space and visual space and really not emphasize tactile space. That was the hidden ground within the art form of the book that he was retrieving so the eyes could be seen. As he said, I'm a 19th century man, and I am concerned about the fate of literature. So that's a way of looking at when he wrote books, what he was doing. So the title, The Medium is the Message, or The Medium is the Massage, is referring to the artifact you're reading. And that it, the reason it is a book, and why Marshall's favoring book.
Absolutely. That's absolutely fascinating. Oh, got it.
Okay, good. All right.
So that was that among this. No, I wanted to add back to the idea of using McLuhan to understand what's going on. For specific things, I have found that there's a lot of value. Emotion of Multitude has helped me enormously.
Yeah, shall we describe what that is?
Well, one of the things that we discussed with Eric today, which was very interesting, was that two observations that I was saying that the civil society is replacing social classes. So you don't, you know, talk about, you know, upper class, lower class, middle class, whatever.
You're saying that civil society.
The civil society is a kind of a global imaginary mass of people who belong, whether they know it or not, to the same common space and common kind of...
Right. It's democratic.
Agreed upon modes of behavior and expectations from leaderships and responsibilities.
Right. So the left or the Marxist class warfare doesn't apply perceptually anymore.
Which is right. But Eric did say something interesting about the fact that over the years, maybe there's less talk about it right now, although over the years, people have always talked about upper class and middle class, but you never talk about lower class.
Right.
You just don't mention it. It doesn't exist. It disappears. It's out of sight. And that was very intelligent. He said, because it's the ground, once again.
Yes.
And I thought that was a very interesting observation. Now, you see what I'm saying? That's a McLuhan tool, the figure ground business.
Right. Now, I've got a supplement to that. Intake Today, very important, you know, short statement. He says in the past there was classes and there was the battle between affluence and poverty. He says under electric conditions, everybody suffers hardship. Everybody, all classes. That's a condition in the global theater or global village and global theater. It's a very little part of Take Today, but it's really important. Everybody's involved in making sense, making meaning, and making pattern, and making survival in a tribal society.
Equally suffering hardship. Yeah,
right.
That's actually it's a new kind of equalizer.
Yeah.
It's a great observation.
Yeah.
It's a good one. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, there was another one which... give me your view on grammar as the root of media awareness.
Okay, so Eric defines in the laws of media, dialectics is the abstract thought of the mind. Grammar looks for the seeds of etymology, philology, and I guess meaning. And rhetoric is the act of persuasion. So when McLuhan says that media come from our bodies? That's our grammatical statement. He's updating philology by saying, or entomology, where do words, where do media? And he said in the end of his career that his big discovery was that all media were words, and he would italicize words. So if the words come from our bodies, media come from our bodies, that's the grammatical insight. That's the grammatical eureka. So grammar is the root of media awareness. You see what I'm saying there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. I do, sort of.
Well, grammar is to find the seeds of the meanings of words. The seeds of all our media environments are our body. That's the original meaning, the landscape that every media is extended from.
That comes from Vico in some fashion.
Yes, yeah. Vico began that.
Yeah. But and I'm not against that at all, in fact. It's just that I need to...
It's not totally accurate. My statements... Some of them, most of them are accurate, but when I say downplaying of dialectical ploys, I would have to add to that. But when he's writing books, he highlights dialectical ploys. He downplays it when he's talking or using other media. But when he does a book, he highlights dialectical interplay.
That's the natural consequence of having to write, man.
Yes. Yeah. And
it happened to me, too.
Yeah, in the book you translated, From Cliché to Archetype, he has chapters, eye, comma, ear, you know. He doesn't put in kinetic and tactile space. He just says eye, ear. And that is almost the only dialectic you can have in a book if you write in normal prose. But if you do Finnegan's Wake, you see how it's done. Joyce is including smell and kinetic spaces in the writing. That's why it's visually unreadable.
Mm-hmm. Has to be spoken.
Yes, begin.
You know, I have no experience of Ireland whatsoever, so I have to go there and get the Irish accent in my ears.
I went there on my trip, you know, this summer, first time in Dublin, and I was struck about how tiny it was and how local and dinky. It was incredible.
It's a sweet town.
I guess so. Yeah, it's little wooded taverns. What do you call that? A little rustic or old or crafty.
It feels Irish.
Oh yeah, and they have a big obelisk in the middle of the main street. So I said to the kids hang out there. You know, 20-year-olds, college students. So I said, what is this thing for? Is there a telecommunications at the top? I thought it was like their mini version of the CN Tower. And he says, no, no, it doesn't have that. I said, what's it for? He goes, the shape.
Well, you know.
He's right, but I don't ever say, well, it's there for the shape.
No, but you see, that's the Irish.
Yeah.
Another Irish bull.
Yeah. They're so intrigued by the vertical shape, they made a huge monument to it. That's iconic. It's looking at the boundary.
So you saw Annalisa Plurabelle?
I did do the tour of the Ulysses. I spent a couple days at the James Joyce Center, which was fantastic. They've digitized Ulysses, and they have these incredible charts and parts of each chapter. I took a couple days going through it, and then I did the walking tour where you put the headset on, like going around a museum, and you walk around the town or the city. Well, I got way behind after a couple hours, so I grabbed a cab, and I paid him extra to drive me the rest of the route. And he drove me around for 2 hours, and I got out to Phoenix Park and all the outer parts that would be very hard to walk to. And he showed me different taverns that are not known in the tourist map, and he took pictures of me in front of these obscure parts of the Joyce world.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow, that's a privilege.
Yeah.
And that's fabulous.
If I can remember the joke, he said, the best Joycean thing you ever heard was in class one day, and now there's a gypsy kid, and gypsies... Joyce was a gypsy word, gypsy name or gypsy clan. So the teacher is talking about James Joyce and points out Joyce did this and Joyce did that. And the gypsy student says, I don't know if the teacher's linked to the gypsies. Maybe they did. Maybe he said it was a gypsy word. So the little kid or the kid, however old, let's say a teenager, puts up her hand and says, no, he was not a gypsy. I know all the gypsies, and there's no Joyces in our group.
That is funny.
They knew everybody, and that guy, the pitcher, the head of James Joyce, he was not a Joyce because she knew them all. I never saw that guy before. As if she would know the guy. He'd been dead, 60 years.
That's a lovely thing.
Yeah. So that was his favorite Joyce story. This cabbie guy.
So you see, you've got to get that kind of experience. I would love to have the same tour. I must say, it would be fascinating, totally fascinating.
Yeah,
and it's also very moving. And is Dublin looking sort of healthy, or is it another one of these?
No, it looks old. It's dinky. It's like it looks like a suburb of London. You know, like downtown London, you have fairly high buildings on that shopping stretch. But the rest of it, you just get outside of that. London's dinky too. I mean, I lived in New York City for a year or so. I've got that. But even it's sort of like Toronto. It's just little low one floor kind of stuff, two floor stuff.
Anyway,
I was thinking about how London is this huge capital and how dinky it is compared to New York
City.
Dinky.
I don't like to go to London. I really don't.
No, I don't like England. No, I'm not intrigued with their culture. Yep, I'm not.
The culture is interesting and certainly has history, but.
But London's not great.
But London is not the place where I'd like to spend most of my time.
I agree.
But some people just go nuts. Italians go absolute bananas over London. So, hey.
Do you know the story? Giorgio Gomelsky is the real root of our pop culture. He's the one who first managed the Beatles and then managed the Rolling Stones, then the Yardbirds. That's a whole amazing story. But because he... wandered around Europe after the war, he met Italian avant-garde filmmakers. And so he's in London in, 65. And Antonioni is a friend of his. Now, the Europeans never considered London a worthwhile place to visit, the European artists and bohemians and that. And all of a sudden, this mod thing is happening in London. And the Parisians and Romans and Italians are, puzzled. What? How could anything be happening in London? So Antonioni says, I'm coming to London. He calls Gomelsky and asks him to show him around the scene, the odd scene that was happening, and that led to Blow Up. And you'll see the Yardbirds in Blow Up. So Gomelsky is a big hidden ground to this to our electric culture in the pop music sense. But I'm reminded of that because the Italians, like you, as a European, do not like London, or back then didn't, and even Antonioni didn't like it. And he was forced to go and make a movie about it because the global village was moving towards that London sensibility, right? So, and it just struck me how they really thought nothing could ever come out of London. They were shocked at what was happening in the mid-60s.
Well, that is absolutely amazing to think that there was a surprise around that. I mean, I was in London during that time, and it's true. I can remember the feel. There was excitement in the air, and there were a lot of things happening in style that you could actually feel. But then later, it became very dour.
Yes,
that's the trouble, and I hate all its financial obsession. That too. It's associated with all kinds of money. It cost an FF, that's a fucking fortune, to go to have a bedroom in a hotel in London. It's very, very expensive, and on top, it's not friendly.
Well, LaRouche makes an interesting point. The Commonwealth is the last empire, and that is the capital, the city of London, and the Queen is the capital of the global empire, the Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm.
So it is the visual space and extremists. Money is visual space.
Yeah, absolutely. That's interesting. I didn't know that that comment had been made.
Yeah, the Commonwealth. We don't think of the Commonwealth, or I don't think of it.
Well, it's because Canada got out of it.
Yeah, we got out of it. We do not recognize it anymore. But
back to our job, because I'm going to have people are going to start having coming here, so it's probably a better idea that we continue.
Let's get
work.
Into a bit of Barry, unless you have one more point to make on the inventory.
I probably will come back to it. I just wanted to congratulate you for bringing them out. It's useful to have that line. I like the lists as well because they sometimes help. And I have to, you know, I have a few other things. I mean, I'll send them to you when I, as I come across them.
Right.
But that's a very good, it's a very comprehensive
list of points that nobody knows. Nobody has ever seen that inventory. And,
so
you'll,
I,
and
yeah.
you'll see that it's repeated in a lot of McLuhan's writings.
Mm-hmm. No, it is. I'm totally, I'm aware, I recognize everything. The only thing that I hadn't recognized, that's why I asked the question, was the joyous use of the tactile aesthetic, but you explained it very well. So let's go back then, let's go to some another part of it. Yeah, the whole idea of politics, the economics, management, we've gone through that a little bit, but
I think we will go back, let's come back to that. And did we do management? To decentralize the centralizer through management by prevision. Well, let's do it anyway.
To that one, I could hear the voice of Barry.
Yes.
But, management by prevision.
But here's what it is. It is what Marshall called not a participatory democracy. It is a anticipatory democracy. He starts saying that in the early 70s. Now, that's what I call tetrad management, that the elites knew that things extended, obsolesced, retrieved, and flipped into. I think I told you that when Bush first met Gorbachev, when the wall went down, just after that, I think it's like December 89 in Malta, what did Gorbachev ask for? He asked for the sociological algorithms so that he could handle the breakup of the Soviet Union and all these retrievals and flips going on. And I call that tetrad management. That is what Barry's getting at here, management by prevision, which soars above management by objectives.
Very interesting. Yeah, no, but it also reverses something else that, well, actually, it's the inverse of the rearview mirror. It's the inverse. It's the opposite of the rearview. It's the opposite direction.
Yeah, it's the future
of the mirror.
The future,
right?
Mirror.
Yeah.
And the future is the future is the present, so you can include the future in the present as well as the past in the present. And so management by prevision refers to the 10 thunders of Finnegan's Wake that was left out of the book.
Yes.
And it's important. It soars above management by objectives, which is the idiocy of the presidential election or any campaigning, is trying to determine the goals. When goals move faster than plans can change, that's the hypocrisy, that the campaigners never say that fact. See, it would serve Obama well to just talk McLuhan to show the problem and the dilemma of his situation.
Right.
And then to leave decisions to people on the spot, in quotes, on the spot, who can recognize the laws of their instantly changing situation, demanding instant action. That would allow the people to improvise ad hoc their solutions locally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because they're on the spot. Like right now, so many of the municipalities in the United States are bankrupt. And when that gets officially named, you got a real problem in the United States, because the federal government gets their money from the municipalities. It just goes that way, up. And that is where everything's teetering on a precipice of the abyss. And and already, because they're so bankrupt, the municipalities, they're already improvising stuff, including legalizing marijuana just to get cash flow.
That is lovely.
Yeah. All
it's
these
so
people.
But,
okay.
What is not fun, of course, is the fact that they could run out of money to that extent. How did they let it happen? That's another question.
Well, that's what Marshall predicted. You can't buy, sell, or steal the electric environment. It's a software communism. Cash, visual space does not measure the wealth in an information environment. That's why the crash in 1929 happened. McLuhan said that the wealth that was happening in the radio environment could not be contained and organized by the accountants.
Hmm.
And then we have a hyper level of that in 2008 when credit between banks could not be measured anymore. There was just too much happening.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Fascinating.
Yeah, visual space and objectives fall apart.
Mm-hmm. So now we have micromanaging in sort of smithereens.
In smithereens, and everybody's on the spot. and everybody is making up patterns, you know, improvising. I don't want to say lying, but everybody is continuing to type and communicate, and there's no basis of what anybody is saying other than keep talking. You know, Bush.
That's a professor for you.
Yeah. And Bush, George, the second Bush after 9/11, he expressed that within his cultural framework. He said, resume shopping, which is with the American capitalist business kinetic space, right? Out there, move around acquiring objects. And it's in that kinetic space, and that meme is obsolete in the tactile acquisition that everybody's doing with their BlackBerries and iPhones. So tactile space, kinetic space becomes archetypal, not just art form, it becomes archetypal, and then that becomes sport and football, and that's why the American is obsessed with kinetic space. And McLuhan has that in Laws of Media. Tactile space pushed to extreme flips into kinetic space. That's in Eric's Laws of Media.
You remind me of that. Management. So we've done sort of.
So decentralize the centralizers through management by prevision. In other words, anything that they would recommend, you point out as obsolete. What are your goals, sir? You know, a reporter should do this. What's your objective? And then be ready to cancel and point out how the objective could not be realized.
Yeah, which is more or less what McLuhan used to do with his business consulting.
Yes, that's right. He'd say they didn't know what business they were in.
Yeah. Which probably flustered the few.
What'd you say?
It probably made the few fluster a bit, you know, being quite unsettled by this remark. You know, what was it that Westinghouse was in the business of information, not of lighting?
No, or was that IBM?
No.
Westinghouse not in the business of lighting. It's in the business of information.
The bulb is 360-degree information.
Yes,
that's what it is.
And
it's a beautiful thought, I have to say.
Yes, and what McLuhan in the end, though, I think he said something similar to IBM, he would actually say that to every business. You're not what you think you are in hardware terms. You're involved in information exchange where everything affects everything.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. No.
And that's chaos. That's the chaos. That's the chaos butterfly effect.
Which means that we're back to Vico again.
Well, who did Vico retrieve? Did he retrieve the fathers of the church?
I don't know. That's a good point. He talks about legends, heroes. He talks about gods. He talks about heroes and legends. He must have retrieved the Greek. Much more the Greek or the it's a post-Renaissance, but still much into the
you know what he retrieved? McLuhan said that for the Greeks, the gods were technologies. So Vico retrieved the technological meaning of gods, but the first technology he dealt with was language, and that's all he got to emphasize. But there may be the technical aspect of the gods that Vico retrieved.
Yeah. Can't really sort of pinpoint. I reread Vico 3 months ago, not all of it, but in Italian, and I have to say, I'm okay, but it requires two or three times before I really get it straight. I mean, I get all the nuance, which I don't...
Right, the main Vico scholar, the one who, I forget his name, but when you buy Vico, this guy, translated or organized it, the main Vico text, at least the one that was available in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. That guy was Don Thiel's roommate at Yale.
Really?
Yeah, Don knew him and knew he was doing Vico back then as a fellow student.
Wow, so they must have had some pretty cool conversation. About,
yes.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Okay, the other thing in this, you look up 1965, the letters to Tom Wolfe. Or a letter, where McLuhan is responding to the article and elaborating, expanding on what Tom doesn't know. And he points out that all the modern arts, which are going towards tactility in the early 20th century, are retrieving a normal awareness for the patristic fathers. Now, that's incredible, because a lot of the artists were anti-church, anti-Vatican, Gnostics, esoterics, Platonists, Satanists, whatever, right? And you would never associate the artist with church father awareness. That's Marshall's one of his most radical ideas.
Well, I don't. I have to say, I don't see. I understand very well when Fry plays with the Great Code and these various kind of underlying narratives and structures. I get that, but I don't see this one.
Okay, here's the simple version. Anthropology is influencing everybody. Joyce is meeting with Levy Brule. Pound meets with another guy. Forget his name. They're all intrigued with anthropology, and McLuhan says anthropological awareness was natural to the fathers and probably even the disciples. They went around encountering tribes and different sensibilities, and they had to understand how to put them on, how to prompt them, probe them. The anthropological awareness is what I meant by what's retrieved by modern art, radical modernism. Is that making more sense?
Yeah. No, it does. It's...
But here, you know, Tom Wolfe is hanging out in New York City among the hip, and McLuhan's saying, well, these hip people are just retrieving the fathers. And, you know, and the knee-jerk reaction is, what do you mean the Catholic Church? What do they know about what we know about? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, that is actually one of these sideline insights, I call them.
Sidebars.
Sideline insights, like, you know... It comes from the relationship much more than the actual statement.
Yes, and it's also McLuhan being a Catholic propagandist. He's saying that, you know, Thomism is the ground of the 20th century conceptually.
Yeah, I have to say that I'm feeling not entirely persuaded by that. I'm not even.
That's why I said conceptually. Perceptually,
yeah, no.
It's a different matter. But you know what my Marshall said to Richard, that American critic. He did the first Kostolanitz.
Yes.
He says, well, Kostolanitz quotes him. This is like in January 1967, right when McLuhan's going to have his big year in the New York Times. He has McLuhan saying, "Well, people need concepts to get a grip on reality." So McLuhan admits that there's a conceptual level to what he's presenting, and concepts are natural when you read books. You interpret books conceptually, abstractly. But that's just a side project. Marshall actually wants to get at the United Nations.
But did you say wait a minute. Did you say people need concept to grab reality?
To grasp, to get a grip on reality. This is the quote, if it's accurate.
That's absolutely wonderful. No, really, hang in there. It's a fabulous idea, and it's totally true.
Yeah.
And I can see it, and that's a multi-level, multi-sensorial experience.
Yes, it's McLuhan said, let the books be, he asked in Exploration in the 50s, what is the role of the book today? And he figured out the role was to be a toolkit for concepts, because the book evokes conceptual thinking. So all his stuff, Medium as Message, was interpreted as theories, and that's how the American read it and the Canadian read it. Oh, here's an interesting new theory. Everybody interpreted Marshall's books as concepts to help them get a grip on the changes of the 60s, and then they didn't understand why McLuhan would diss that and talk about percepts when he was interviewed or approached about it. He was showing that the book is a subplot. It's a little probe for literate people, for the subculture of literacy.
Yeah, not for sure.
And his real agenda was to get to the United Nations and get there and monitor the global thermostat of media environments by measuring sensory profiles of the populations. That was his...
Yeah. I would like to see that happening. But it's great. That's a great suggestion.
Yeah,
I don't know if it would work or not.
He couldn't do it.
Well, the point is, if you think about the use of radio that animated the horrible war between the Tutsis and the Hutus.
Yes, in Africa, right?
There, if you had been able to simply say, guys, you're off radio for a while.
That's all you have to do.
You might have avoided a genocide.
Yeah, you dump newspapers and books. The Firesign Theater, remember them? Remember Firesign Theater? There used to be a mobile in the center given to Marshall by them, so they were friends of Marshall. Well, in one of their albums, it might be called Waiting for the Electrician, they have I think I mentioned this to you before, but I'm talking to somebody recently. They have the Enola. Remember the thing that dropped the bomb was the Enola Gay?
Yes.
So the Firesign Theater comedians are going along in the Enola McLuhan, and they're saying, okay, we're flying over Venezuela, bomb them with books. They actually satirized this notion that was first heard in the Playboy interview. See,
oh, that is funny. But
isn't that incredible? But yeah. The Enola McLuhan bombing cultures with different media because they need media causing. You just turn off the radio. But McLuhan, the reason he laid that out, which is very impractical, nobody would do that. He couldn't do it. I mentioned to a couple of professors back then, and they said, well, that's fascism. You can't impose environments on people, right? The liberal thinks that's fascist. But McLuhan said, no, programming is necessary. We're already fascist. Everybody's a fascist. So the idea of giving that answer in the Playboy interview is that literate man requires a solution. If you're going to criticize society or something, you have to have a solution. So he invented this solution to fulfill that sense of completing his agenda. But it was manipulated satire. He knew that it could not be done, but he did have it as a necessary solution for the conceptual mind looking for answers in his reading matter. Right? That's what's going on there.
Wow. That is fabulous.
Yeah, McLuhan created, he used to say, advertising creates a disease and offers the cure. So he said, we're in big trouble with electric media, and then he had a cure, you know, global thermostat management.
Yeah. Let's move on. As I said, very soon I will have to
That's
stop,
okay.
So,
So education. To learn the old disciplines as art forms inside academic walls. So academic walls are still going to be there while exploring the new problems outside where the action is. To shift stress from conceptual to perceptual training where, quote, bull sessions, unquote, retrieve dialogue and lectures become entertainment.
Yeah, I wish that were true. Actually, I've tried to make that happen in my classes anyway.
It could be done because you know what is left out is the kids come to school to get visual space or the dialectic, because that's their meme gene. Remember, and to supplement that, McLuhan says you can make people literate without any books in the environment, but if you put them in suburban grids and straight lines and highways and linear, you know, direction through kinetic media, you are making an educated, literate person.
Mm-hmm.
Not educated, you're making a literate person. That's very interesting. You don't need books to create literacy. You just have to have the regular industrial environment.
Paul Levinson had put it in a very poetic way in his Digital McLuhan, I think, one of his books, and he put it, said that the medium is like a tint that covers all the fabrics.
What did you say, a tint?
Like a blue. He used the word blue. Like imagine, he said like the media act like a tint.
A tint.
A tinter, yeah, a special color that you put on fabric, and it's
everywhere, all over the fabric.
Yeah, it infiltrates, but it has this characteristic of being mild, so
yes,
unsuspected. Yeah. It infiltrates absolutely every substance, and that's what he that's the image he used, and I thought it was very appropriate because of what you know how Marshall Saltz think.
Right. So the tint for Western literate societies is the students. They are on the surface motivated by electric media to be with it, but at the core of themselves, they are literate people, and they require to sit there and be lectured and have that old classroom format, as I call it, a gene/meme. The meme is.
Mm-hmm.
See, Marshall discovered the mimic code in 1953, the same year Crick and Watson discovered the DNA code, the genetic code. He discovered the controlling thing on a macro level of social behavior.
Did he use the word meme?
No, that wasn't coined until 1976 by Richard Dawkins in The Selfish Gene.
So
but,
that's what I'm saying.
But the word medium is a meme. You can make that meaning. And so Marshall discovered the sociological genetic code. So I'm calling it the mimic code.
Yes, yeah.
In the same year as Crick and Watson. That's when he started to really go public. That's when he formed Explorations.
I didn't know it was the same year. Isn't that?
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Coincidence. That's not a coincidence.
No.
Would you call it a coincidence?
No, the Lord works in mysterious ways.
I know.
The Lord is making its own composition, or their own composition. You know what I mean? Language is the creator. If you have a God, the idea that God's something out there beyond us or something that's molding humans, it's through language and media.
Well, speaking of the language of... that you put in, the these things, you have prophecy, you have futurism, communication, education. That's all terribly religious, you know.
Yeah, that's Barry's list. This is Barry's inventory.
Was Barry religious?
No. As a matter of fact, he said Marshall was always bugging him to convert to Catholicism. He told me that.
Really?
Yeah. And Barry, in his smirking way or beaming face, he would say, he'd be laughing, he'd be sort of like, Marshall was a kid, he didn't understand, he wasn't very severe, he wanted me to be a Catholic, that's not going to happen, Barry the secular humanist pagan, right? And but Barry said, well, what happens, then he says, what happens when you die, and there are no secrets. That was his understanding of post-death.
No, I don't get it.
He says, when you die, he believed you survived after death.
Mm-hmm.
But he says the condition it was that there were no secrets between anybody in the death zone or in the,
right,
in heaven.
Well, that's interesting. That's about what's happening right now.
Yes, we've electrically simulated death, the heaven zone.
No, it's interesting. But that's what I call the ethics of transparency. We are looking into that. I'm looking very much into that general direction.
Okay, well, have you looked at Baudrillard's book, The Transparency of Evil? Because he's trying to describe the transparency of the global theater constantly, and he's throwing in the concept of evil. And it's interesting how he's not being judgmental, but he wants to use that category. I think he considers evil just obscene multiplicity. He says that what is plaguing people, and he wrote this in the 80s and 90s, was the obscenity of imagery, the too muchness of everything,
mm-hmm,
of post-literate media imagery. And I think he called that evil, or an extreme situation. So you might want to look at what he says about transparency, because it's McLuhan-esque, but made postmodern.
Very interesting. Thanks for the ref. Send it to me.
What, the book? No, it's a book.
Oh, it's a whole book?
Yeah, The Transparency of Evil. Came out in the early 90s. It's a really good book.
I don't have an idea how it'd be called in French. La transparence du mal? I don't know. I'll have to check.
I'll
get to the root of this.
Right. And he talks about AIDS and viruses and, all kinds of things as part. He basically says that our trend towards sterility and environments flipped into, lethality, that's a word. And so these extreme viruses were a reaction. It's a tetrad, a flipping of too much sterility in our environments. And he said terrorism was another part of this extreme reaction.
I've got to get to that because it contains a lot of stuff I'm concerned with. Right, so...
Now, did you ever hear this thought?
Yeah.
And this is a good one. Bruce Powell, he during the McLuhan Centenary, maybe when he was in Barcelona, he said this.
Yes.
He said that a CSIS person, he knew somebody in Canadian intelligence, said the reason there's no terrorism in Canada is a deal was made with the terrorists by CSIS that they will allow terrorists to have a safe house in Canada as long as they don't do any terrorist acts.
No.
That's what Bruce said. Just putting it in the record there. You can.
But it was said by whom?
A CSIS,
Oh, but it was a CSIS, a student CSIS.
No, a CSIS, the Canadian CIA.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
Yeah.
But wait, where did he get that?
A CSIS person told Bruce. He didn't say who. He was like, he's not naming his sources. But he announced it right there in his speech in the McLuhan Centenary in Barcelona, whatever it was. And he said this, that there's a deal by the intelligence agencies of Canada to allow the terrorists to hang out in Canada in exchange that they don't do any terrorism in Canada. That's a pretty controversial statement by Bruce. You might want to take him up on that.
It's amazing. I'm stunned.
Yeah.
I'm not joking. Absolutely flabbergasted.
Yeah.
I will try. I'll try and reconnect with good old Bruce.
Oh, yeah. Bruce, after I met with him in Barcelona, I inspired him a lot. Just got, people don't get to hear the McLuhan reality enough from somebody. I can do it because I can remember everything McLuhan said, right? So it gets people in the McLuhan probing mood. And he then asked me to be part of the second recording, which is not up on YouTube yet. But he wrote me after. He says, I'd like to get out in a boat more. You inspire me. And so I said, well, maybe you could join me in Derek's dialogue. And he said, sure. So maybe we can bring him in at some point.
That would be great. It'd be
yeah.
fun. Fascinating, too. Absolutely. Well, let's do that. Okay, let's call it a day for the moment, because I really should get things ready. And I'm leaving tomorrow morning early, so I'm also doing my suitcase at the same time, trying to find the time. So let's see if we can, not tomorrow, but
later this week, do another one. Where will you be?
I'm off to Rome.
Okay, so that's okay.
I'm off to Rome. No, hold it. I'm off to Barcelona, of all places. We're launching the book, The Point of Being, and we're also, and I'm giving a talk on the ethics of, it's called The Ethics of Transparency in the Age of Big Data. But I would like very much go back to the Baudrillard book. That's
okay.
Sure.
Now, you're doing a lecture. Is it is like the same form as Bruce, so people can participate through the Internet? You know, with Matteo and the woman. I forget her name.
Yeah.
Are you doing it with them?
Yes. But it's not, I don't think that Bruce is involved, is he?
Oh, yeah, that's Bruce's team. You know, that's who he's doing opening time with.
Agreed, but he's. I don't think he's planning to be in Barcelona.
No, he's not there till next, you know, in the next summer or something. But I'm just wondering, you're doing that with Matteo. When I was doing it the end of July with Bruce, there was online streaming and people could participate.
How nice! And did it? There was a lot of participation.
Not much. I don't think I didn't notice any. I mean, it was hardly anybody there.
That's the problem with, we always talk about streaming and immediately have a little bubble in our head saying, ooh, there's lots of people at the other end of this, but no.
That's right. No, they're too busy making their own
space. One rat and two cats.
They're too busy making their own Facebook spaces.
That's exactly.
Nobody's listening.
We're all into our little bubble.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, man.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
Talk to you later.
Bye.